You're listening to a 3CR podcast created in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.
3CR would like to acknowledge the Kulin Nation, true owners, caretakers and custodians of the land from which we broadcast. 3CR pays respect to elders, past and present of the Kulin Nation. We recognise their unceded sovereignty.
This is 3CR Breakfast.
Oh, yeah.
Alternative news, analysis, and current affairs. Monday to Friday, 7 a.m. to 8:30 a.m.
Only double.
Clap your hands.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to 3CR Breakfast on Tuesday, the 25th of August, 2026. And thank you to the Radioactive Show, 3CR's national program on nuclear peace and energy issues. My name is Fung, and we've got Visa in the studio with us today, and Julia will be joining us later on. But good morning, Visa.
Morning, Fung. How are you?
I am well. Yeah. As you were asking me just now, I was like, think of something else to say. Think of something more exciting to say. And to be honest, I have nothing.
It's okay to not be exciting, though. Mm. Like, we don't have to always be exciting, I feel like, especially this season of, the like, this time
That's
of year.
That's true. That's true. Yeah. I guess, what have I been up to recently? Recently, I went out of town.
Ooh, yes.
With some friends, which was really nice. And we did a puzzle.
A jigsaw puzzle?
Yeah.
I love that.
Yeah.
Did you finish it?
We did. We started at 5:30 p.m.
Oh, my God.
It was 1,000 pieces.
I was going to ask how many. How long did it take?
We finished at 12:30 a.m.
Incredible. The commitment. I love that.
The commitment.
I love that.
And you know when you're doing a puzzle and you go through those stages where you're feeling really optimistic, you're sorting your pieces, you're finding your border.
Yeah.
And then maybe you're
hit a wall.
Yeah. Maybe you're like two hours in and you're like, what are we doing?
We've made a mistake. Yeah.
We've made a huge mistake. Yeah.
That's why it's impressive, because most people abandon it at that point.
Well, I think it was just my friend and I at that point, and neither of us really wanted to say anything.
That's so fair.
I think once you speak those words aloud.
It, yes, it's manifested.
That's over.
Yeah,
exactly.
That's it.
So we just silently, powered through. And
now you can see you finished the puzzle. That's massive.
And then we had two more people join right at the end for that for that last
just a big push finish at the end.
And then when the puzzle's finished, I don't know, how do you normally feel when you've finished a puzzle?
Yeah, just a bit anticlimactic, to be honest. Because I'm like, no, what do I do with this?
Exactly. You're like, oh, yeah, it looks like the box.
The picture on the box. Yeah, pretty much. And I remember this. I remember sharing with you going to a house party ages ago, and I randomly saw someone started a puzzle. Mm. And then I went full project manager mode and like, okay, we're going to do this. And I picked out all the border pieces and like classic high school teacher energy.
Yeah. And then your friends were like, Fiza, we're at
everybody lost interest. Yeah. Everyone's like, Fiza, stop.
This isn't a school project.
Someone restrain her.
Yeah.
So,
I feel like the puzzle, maybe it's just for a certain type of people, but like you see a puzzle and it does something to you.
Yeah, I think that's the certain type of people.
Over you.
Yeah, it calls to me like Jumanji.
Yes.
Like
the freaking. Yeah. But also, what's a party without, you know, having a very specific role?
Yeah, exactly. And give me something to do. Why am I supposed to socialize, please?
Delegating roles to others.
Yeah, I'm good at that. Mm. I'm good at that. I'm like, you're a class monitor. You're managing the chips. You top up the drinks.
Yeah.
I'll figure out the border pieces of this puzzle.
Yeah.
Leave me alone.
Mm-hmm. And when you're combing through the pieces, you're looking for like your border pieces and you're like, I swear I've looked through all of these pieces. How are there no more border pieces?
Yeah, exactly. And this is not complete. Mm. And then, I'm always paranoid that there's a missing piece or more than one missing piece.
Yeah. Even awful. If it's a brand new.
Yeah. 100%. Because people make
plastic.
Mistakes.
That's
true. Yeah. And
that's
then
true.
I'm like, if that's the case, this is going to be a disaster. Mm. I am going to be furious about this puzzle for the rest of my life.
Such a test.
It is. It is such a test of character.
So many. Yeah, you have to like go through so many battles.
Who needs therapy? Just do a puzzle with someone, and then you'll learn the best and the worst
about the other person and about yourself.
Absolutely. I do not like who I get become around puzzles. No. It's not nice.
Well, that ended up being a really exciting conversation. So.
You'll you. Spin a good yarn for
yeah. Okay, so let's have a chat about what's coming up on yes. today's show. We're starting off with an excerpt from 3CR's Out of the Blue. Sabrina spoke to Dr. Kim Reed about El Nino, which is the climate pattern happening right now. And they talk about this phenomenon in detail and shed some light on popular headlines regarding this climate pattern. At 7:30, we'll be joined by Jed Pika, who is a non-binary lesbian and General Secretary of Migrante Australia, which is an alliance of grassroots migrants organisation of Filipinos and their families. Jed will be on the show to talk about their newly launched campaign, Laban Migrante, which is fighting against the exploitation of migrant workers in so-called Australia.
And at 7:45, we'll be joined by Dr. Sophie Rudolph, one of the branch committee member of the NTEU. The NTEU Unibail staff will be striking this Thursday as part of their enterprise bargaining that commenced last November. And at 8 o'clock, we'll be speaking to Mel Fisher from the Anti-Poverty Centre about the latest report from Ciro that revealed Australian homes are some of the most expensive to heat or cool, and households who live in even 1.7-star homes pay more than 6 times in energy bills than those living in energy-efficient homes. Mm. So, yeah.
And then at 8:15, we'll be listening to Karen Fletcher, executive officer at Flatout, who spoke recently at the rally to oppose the so-called No Air in Prison Bill, which was held on the steps of Vic Parliament on Wednesday, the 12th of August. And in that speech, Karen spoke out against the mass incarceration of Aboriginal Torres Strait Islanders, as well as mistreatment of people in prison. So that's our show for today. We'll be back with the news headlines after this.
Some folks know about it, some don't. Some will learn to shout it, some won't. But sooner or later, baby, here's a ditty. Say you're gonna have to get right down to the real nitty gritty. Let's get right down to the real nitty gritty now.
You're listening to 3CR Tuesday Breakfast, and these are the news headlines for today, Tuesday the 25th of August, 2026. The latest Australian and Queensland Government Reef Water Quality Report card has revealed the reef has failed to meet multiple water quality targets. Analysis from the Wilderness Society has uncovered that 11 out of 13 water quality targets have been missed. This includes targets for inorganic nitrogen, fine sediments, and pesticide risks, which have all not been met. Water quality across seagrass, coral, and marine environments were all experiencing poor conditions. Thousands of hectares of forests and bushland along reef watercourses are being bulldozed, destroying the reef's natural filtration system. This destruction is largely for beef pastures and is letting in dirty mud and chemical runoff into the reef ecosystem. Emily Dixon, campaigns manager at the Wilderness Society, elaborated, "This report provides critical insight into Australia's performance in managing the health of the Great Barrier Reef. If what the governments are currently doing is failing to meet targets, then it is time for a conversation about what to do differently." In other news, new research from the Australia Institute reveals that the 5 largest gambling companies won $5.4 billion from Australian punters in 2023 to 2024. This is despite these companies claiming they have made, quote, next to no profit. These 5 companies paid just $0.1 billion in company tax, amounting to just 2% of their winnings. In the same time period, these companies spent at least $600 million in advertising and promotions, equivalent to 6 times their tax payments. Further, these 5 gambling corporations spent $720 million in fees to sporting organisations, the majority of which were in the horse racing industry. Martin Thomas, CEO of the Alliance for Gambling Reform, commented, "We have long known the harm these companies cause in Australian communities, causing bankruptcies, health and mental health issues, exacerbating domestic violence, and also leading some people to suicide. But now to hear that they give so little back through their tax minimisation schemes is appalling."
Also in the news, 50,000 people are calling for a Human Rights Act in Australia. A petition for the act was handed to a collection of Greens, Labour and Independents at Australian Parliament House last Thursday. Human Rights Watch and Amnesty International worked together to write the petition, which was also backed by another 184 organisations. The petition follows a renewed agitation for Human Rights Act by Independents Andrew Wilkie and Dr. Helen Haynes this May. Human Rights Act already existed at the state level in Victoria, the ACT and Queensland. A federal Human Rights Act would outline a set of enforceable human rights protections to guide federal government decision and policy making. Caitlin Reger, CEO of Human Rights Law Centre, explained, "Every person deserves respect, dignity and equality regardless of bank balance or postcode. Human Rights Acts in Victoria, Queensland and the ACT have helped people stay in housing, access medical care and given people a tool to challenge unfair treatment when injustice happens. The Albanese government and federal parliament should legislate an Australian Human Rights Act so that everyone can enjoy their human rights." Finally, in the headlines, children are being increasingly recruited by armed groups in Colombia in recent years, according to a new report by Human Rights Watch. Since 2021, at least 1,500 children have been recruited, with a marked increase from 2023 onwards. A third of these children are aged between 10 and 14, young enough for their recruitment to be considered an international war crime. The research found these armed groups are taking advantage of poverty, lack of education and social exclusion to recruit children, promising money and prestige, increasingly through the use of social media. The Colombian government's existing policies and strategies to prevent child recruitment and rescue those already recruited are falling short, according to Human Rights Watch. Juanita Gobertas, America's director at Human Rights Watch, noted, "Armed groups in Colombia are recruiting children with impunity, as protection systems are failing and social media platforms have become a more effective recruiting ground. Every child recruited is indicative of a government failure." These have been the news headlines for Tuesday, 25th of August, 2026. You're listening to 3CR Breakfast on 855 AM.
3CR would like to thank our sponsors, Earth Greetings. Cards that connect, care, and celebrate. Support wildlife and habitat with every purchase. Inspired by nature, giving back to the planet. Learn more at earthgreetings.com.au.
Women on the Line, a radical intersectional current affairs program.
Making space for the voices of women and gender diverse people.
Featuring in-depth conversations with guests from so-called Australia and beyond.
Ultimately, we're looking to care for country, to continue our culture, to continue our ceremonies, so that our children have a strong sense of self and belonging.
Just because our marginalisation intersect where we're both disabled, it doesn't change your white privilege. It doesn't change your straight privilege. It doesn't change your able-bodied privilege.
Sex work, the word itself, has been such a word with a lot of stigma. However, we cannot ignore that there are women out there who are making their livelihood out of this job.
Listen every Monday morning at 8:30 on 3CR Community Radio 855 AM or stream live on 3cr.org.au.
Love podcasts? We've got you. Find Women on the Line via the Community Radio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Women on the Line, we're about
feminisms in their multitudes,
First Nations sovereignty,
land back,
trans liberation, poo poo on the turfs,
abolition,
anti-racism,
sex worker rights,
staff liberation,
disability justice,
anti-imperialism,
decolonisation,
an end to borders,
workers' justice,
and so much more.
Women on the Line, broadcasting on the 3CR airwaves since 1986.
Hi, my name is Miss Kinnan. I'm a proud Yorta Yorta, Jajara on Kalkadoon and Yirrindali Aboriginal Sovereign Woman. And you're listening to 3CR, guys. Check in with your friends. Make sure you guys are going good. And also stick up for what's right, yeah? Free Palestine.
You're listening to 3CR Breakfast on 855 AM, 3CR Digital and online at 3cr.org.au. Before that message, we had the news headlines, but right now we're going to listen to an excerpt of Out of the Blue. So last Sunday, the presenter of the show, Sabrina, spoke to Dr. Kim Reid about El Nino, which is a climate pattern happening right now. Dr. Reid explains to listeners what El Nino means and how it affects weather patterns over the globe, not just Australia. She describes this phenomenon in detail and sheds some light on popular headlines. Take a listen to an excerpt of this episode from Sunday, August the 23rd.
Thanks so much for joining me today, Kim. I'm really excited to talk to you. The topic of El Niño, I know in the media there's like a lot of buzz around it, but I guess can you explain sort of in a simple way, what does it all mean? Like when we're in El Niño, putting that in inverted commas, what's actually going on, I guess, in the atmosphere and in the ocean?
Yeah, El Niño always creates a lot of buzz, but first of all, El Niño has been happening for thousands of years. It's not a brand new thing, and it's a naturally occurring variation in ocean temperature and winds across the Pacific Ocean. So during El Niño, we tend to get warmer ocean temperatures over in the eastern side of the Pacific Ocean, central and eastern side, so near South America. And we also get a weakening of the trade winds that would typically blow from east to west across the Pacific Ocean near the equator towards Australia. And on top of that, there's normally a region of storm activity called the Walker Circulation that hovers around sort of northern Australia. And during El Niño, that shifts out across the Pacific Ocean, drawing moisture and clouds away from Australia. So the atmosphere and ocean kind of work together to reduce the amount of moist air hitting Australia.
Interesting. So I feel like maybe in the last 5 years, it feels like it's gotten all of this like attention in the media, but it's always been a thing.
It's always been a thing. So El Niño is part of a broader, what we call oscillation. So you've probably heard the other side of it, La Niña, which is the reverse of everything I just said. Stronger trade winds, colder waters in the eastern Pacific, typically wetter for Australia. And this oscillation between El Niño and La Niña typically occurs every 3 to 7 years, although we have had a few back-to-back events in the last few years, which has caught people's attention, especially because we've also had some quite extreme weather associated with these.
Yeah, is that like normal to have multiple events back to back, or is it kind of like a sort of random thing that happened within the range of normalcy, or is it abnormal?
Yeah, it's not weird to get two back to back. A few years ago, we had three La Niñas in a row. That was weird. So three is unusual, two back-to-back's normal, one by itself is also pretty normal, so it's just in the range of normal. I guess the thing that is weird is we're getting fewer just normal years, so years that aren't La Niña or El Niño, and that's probably why it feels like it's been in the news a lot lately.
Yeah, oh, that's interesting. And I see a lot of headlines talking about super El Niño or record-breaking El Niño. Does that mean record-breaking temperature?
That's a great question, and something people always assume. And a lot of the early headlines were saying that as well. I saw headlines saying catastrophic El Niño could bring catastrophic weather. And there's a lot to unpack there, so I'll go through it slowly. First, what even is a super El Niño? Well, we measure the strength of an El Niño based on those ocean temperatures in the eastern Pacific. So we take a box, which is called NINO 3.4, and it's just a rectangle over the middle of the Pacific Ocean, and we average the ocean temperatures in that box. And when the temperatures in that box exceed 0.8 degrees above average, that's when we're in an El Niño threshold. So that's when the Bureau of Meteorology, along with a couple of other criteria relating to the winds, that's when they'll declare El Niño. Now, a super El Niño is when that threshold or that warming in the Pacific exceeds 2 degrees above normal, which is quite unusual. I think it's possibly the second standard deviation. And so it's basically a lot warmer in that Eastern Pacific region.
Mm. So did you say above 0.8 above average is like what you would maybe call regular, and then above 2 degrees is in like the super category?
Yeah, that's right. Although the BOM, the Bureau of Meteorology, and the World Meteorological Organization don't say super El Nino.
Okay.
They just say strong El Nino. They also don't say Godzilla or Kraken El Nino, which I've also seen.
Great. And you've mentioned ocean temperatures. How do they measure the ocean temperature? Is it with satellite?
It's satellite and buoys mostly, so moorings out in the ocean.
Huh. Interesting.
Yeah, so what's really important to know about the strength of an El Nino is that's just one component of it. So as I mentioned, it's not just the ocean temperature, but it's the weakening of the trade winds that also makes an El Nino. And for Australia, because we're over on the other side of the Pacific Ocean to where that blob of warm water is, it's the strength of the warm water, so how hot it is, doesn't actually have a direct correlation to the rainfall that we get here in Australia. So a stronger El Nino doesn't necessarily mean drier conditions.
Mm.
We can get really dry conditions in a just normal El Nino, and we can get kind of average conditions in a super El Nino. So it depends on a whole lot of factors, not just whether we're in a super El Nino or not.
Mm. I guess the thing that probably comes to a lot of people's minds when we think of like extreme weather conditions, really hot, really dry temperatures, would be the bushfires in 2019-2020. Was that an El Nino year?
That's a great example, because it actually wasn't an El Nino year.
Hmm.
So what was interesting about 2019-2020 is that there'd been 3 years of really dry conditions in the New South Wales, part of Victoria region as well. And there was a weak El Nino during part of it, but the part that was particularly noteworthy wasn't the El Nino, it was what was happening in the Indian Ocean.
Mm.
So El Nino's cousin in the Indian Ocean, called the Indian Ocean Dipole, is kind of the same idea, where you have differences in temperature across the Indian Ocean basin and differences in the strength of the winds across the Indian Ocean. And so when there's warm water to the northwest of Australia, that's called a negative Indian Ocean Dipole, and that's when we tend to get more rain and more northwest cloud bands that can stretch from Broome to Hobart across Australia. But when we have cooler ocean temperatures in the north off the northwest of Australia, that's when we're in what's called a positive Indian Ocean Dipole. And the combination of a positive Indian Ocean Dipole plus El Nino is often when we get our most severe droughts, and that's what really characterized 2019.
Yep.
It wasn't what happened in the Pacific, it was what was going on in the Indian Ocean that had a much stronger influence.
Ah, interesting. Ah, okay. Now, you mentioned that, so they're measuring the temperature off in the eastern side of the Pacific. El Nino is, as I understand, not just something that affects Australia. What kind of effects would we expect, I guess, in other places around the world?
Yeah, that's right. El Nino is a global phenomenon and impacts weather all over the world. So while we tend to see dry conditions here in Australia, we also see dry conditions in Southeast Asia and India, and that's partially due to that shifting of that region of strong rain and storm activity away from us and towards the middle of the Pacific Ocean. So they sometimes get a later onset or a reduced monsoon in India and Asia. And this can be an issue because especially in India, they tend to get quite strong heat waves before the monsoon arrives. So they can get really humid heat waves, which is when you get the temperature plus humidity combining to get really dangerous temperatures for humans.
Yeah.
Because if it's too humid, the human body can't sweat.
Yeah.
And we can't cool ourselves down.
Yeah. I remember it was like a headline that, body temperature 38 or something degrees,
yeah.
And they had a day in Indonesia where it was like above 38 degrees for the first time ever maybe, and like 100% humidity.
Yeah, that's the scary thing. That's what climate scientists, when we say cities may become uninhabitable, a lot of the time we're talking about the heat and humidity combination, where it just gets to a point where the body can't naturally cool, and in a lot of these places there isn't widespread air conditioning.
Yeah.
There's a lot of poverty, and so that can be a recipe for disaster. So as well as the heat, there's also just the reduction in the much needed monsoonal rainfall. Southern parts of Africa also see drier conditions during El Nino. And especially if they get back-to-back El Nino years, that can increase the chance of famine. Central America and also Northwest North America can see drier conditions. So, like I said, increases the chance of wildfires in Canada. But it's not just drying everywhere. Because El Nino shifts rainfall patterns globally, it also means some places actually get wetter. So parts of Southwest America might see increased rainfall, which is good because they're currently very dry at the moment. And then parts of South America as well might see wetter conditions.
That's really interesting. So places that are like not really anywhere near the Pacific, like India and Africa, are also kind of getting effects.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, you would think that El Nino would just impact the Americas, but because the planet is so interconnected and basically in simple language, waves like a ripple across a lake, waves can spread out from the Pacific all the way around the world. A lot of places very far away from the Pacific can be impacted.
That's really interesting. So on Out of the Blue, we're a program all about coasts and oceans. What can we expect for our oceans and marine environments with El Nino?
Yeah, so El Nino has a big impact on the location of fish. Because the waters are warmer generally. So tropical fish might spread further away from the equator. You might see them in places where you didn't see them previously. And then fish that like cold water might move closer to the poles. So you see shifts in migration routes and just the appearance of fish species that you wouldn't expect in certain locations. And that of course has a big impact on the fishing industry. So the reason why it's called El Nino in the first place, which is kind of weird, or you might think it's kind of weird, it doesn't sound very sciencey, but El Nino means little boy in Spanish. And it was originally discovered by Peruvian fishermen back in like the 1600s, because they noticed that there were these warm ocean temperatures that would appear periodically at peak around December. And so they named it after baby Jesus, the little boy child. And Peruvian fishing is still heavily impacted by El Nino today, because when you have warm ocean temperatures, you don't have as much nutrients, because it's the cold water that brings nutrients up from below. And you can lead to quite a large decline in fishing in that region. So there are estimates that past super El Ninos have led to almost a 50% or up to a 50% decline in fish catch near Peru, which of course has a massive impact on their economy and lead to economic hardship.
And I can imagine as well, if it's having impacts on migration of species in the ocean, if it's like something that happens once every 3 years or once every however many years, versus if it's something that's happening every single year, then it can have sort of, I guess, knock-on effects in the rest of the ecosystem.
Yeah, I admit I don't know heaps about the fish ecosystem, but I'm sure it has. I guess one of the other major issues for the marine environment is, of course, coral bleaching. The warmer oceans just mean the corals are more at risk, and if you have back-to-back events, then it means there's less time for the coral to recover in between bleaching events, and therefore increased chance of dying.
That's so interesting. So how long do we expect these conditions to last? And given that, as you've said, it's strong, or perhaps some people would say super El Nino, does that mean that we can expect it to go on for a longer period of time?
That's a good question. The short answer is there isn't really a correlation between the strength and the duration. So El Nino events typically peak in the Southern Hemisphere spring and summer. So
hot girl summer.
Exactly. For the Southern Hemisphere. and then they ease off in autumn, but then they can potentially ramp up again the following winter. So it could last 6 to 9 months. It could last 2 years. We don't really know at this stage yet. The Bureau of Meteorology forecasts to the end of the year are indicating that it will still be around in December, but it's a bit of a wait and see situation.
I guess, yeah, we'll have to wait and see. Thanks so much for answering my questions, Kim. That's, certainly given me a lot to think about. Next time I see a crazy headline about El Nino. I'll remember this. Thanks for joining me.
Thanks for having me.
That was Out of the Blue presenter Sabrina talking to Dr. Kim Reid. She tells listeners about the weather climate pattern El Nino. She discusses the science behind El Nino and what that means for the climate across the globe.
We are now joined by Jed Pika, Filipino non-binary lesbian and General Secretary of Migrant Australia, an alliance of grassroots migrants organisation of Filipinos and their families in so-called Australia. Jed is here to speak about their newly launched campaign, Laban Migrant, fighting against the exploitation of migrant workers and advocating for their rights and welfare. Welcome to 3CR Breakfast, Jed.
Hi, good morning.
Thanks so much for being on our show today. To start, can you tell us about your work at Migrant Australia and what drove you to launch a new campaign called Laban Migrant?
Yeah, of course. Thank you for. So you basically introduced Migrant Australia already. Thank you so much. But yeah, my name is Jed. I'm General Secretary of the Migrant Australia. So it is an alliance of grassroots organizations, Filipino migrant workers here in so-called Australia. We have local chapters in different parts of Melbourne, Sydney, and Perth. And of course, we uphold and advance the rights of welfare of overseas Filipinos. And the Laban Migrante campaign is translated to calling for migrants to stand up and fight. And how it came to it, it was a call after a growing number of Filipino workers across Australia have come forward with different accounts of work-related exploitation and abuse. This is including low wages, wage theft, unpaid superannuation, unsafe working conditions, and some are coerced by their employers. And most of them are on temporary sponsored visas. In hospitality, construction, and automotive. So we can just turn a blind eye in these cases, especially that we have stories like German rape of death that open up the realities of modern slavery that is happening here in so-called Australia.
And we can talk about individual employers that are taking advantage of Filipino and other migrant workers in this country, but we also need to talk about the Australian government. So I was wondering if you could talk us through the government's policies that are contributing to the exploitation of workers.
Yes, absolutely. So the some of the cases that have come forward specific to for A2 visa, so this is a employer-sponsored visa, which obviously opens up abuses and coercion by the employers, but also there is an Australian government scheme of this temporary skilled migration having income threshold of around 79 per annum. But this is meant to incentivize skilled migration, not just the labor shortage, but also this has caused vulnerable conditions. Many workers have reported being forced to hand back portions of their pay, extend their working hours without pay, hand over back their superannuation. And they were also, because this is sponsored visa, they were also threatened with visa cancellation for speaking up, and they are left without contract or payslip or any basic protection. And another thing that we have found out is that on the other end, there's also this type of visa, which is the 407 training visa, with no income threshold, and then they have lower requirements. And, of course, without any proper regulation, it opens even more abuses and exploitation, especially of international students and temporary migrant workers.
Thanks for that, Jed. I know that this has been an ongoing problem that's faced by many workers and international students. What can you tell us, though, about the role of the Filipino government in this?
Yes, of course. There's also the role of the Filipino government in this, because Filipino migrants are all mostly left-handed in the Philippine government. The Filipino migrants here, they're left in an unfamiliar country. There's a lack of accessible support services to migrant workers. And they don't know, they're not aware of how to recognize exploitation, or don't know what to say when this is happening. And this vulnerability, of course, traces back home to the lack of jobs and extremely low wages in the Philippines. And of course, the Philippine government also systematically pushes us out with this labor export program. Mm.
And yeah, so it seems like at every stage, workers are really struggling to have workers' rights. Like you said in the beginning, in the Philippines, with low wages and fewer job opportunities. In Australia, when they're struggling to, at the beginning, when they're struggling to detect if they're being exploited, and then, you know, throughout that process with their lack of rights. I guess it's why it's so important that we've got your campaign, such as Laban Migrante, which you launched with The Gathering on the 9th of August. Can you share your reflections on the event and the response from the broader community?
Yeah, it was a very great event that happened. The Filipino migrant workers and their families came together and shared their experiences. We got overwhelming support from the broader Filipino community. It was also a gateway for more and more of workers to be empowered to find their voice and speak about their own experience of exploitation and abuses.
And what are your demands, and what's next for Migrante Australia, as well as this new campaign?
So the Laban Migrante campaign is in its initial stages at the moment, but our objective is to expose and surface what is happening on the ground and to empower Filipino migrant workers to stand up and fight for exploitation. Of course, if there's people that are speaking up, we'll be having more opportunities to be heard, and it will be great if a lot of people could also offer their support for the campaign.
Yeah, and speaking of that, what are some things that listeners can do to support Filipino and other migrant workers?
Yes, absolutely. If the listeners know any migrants, or if, even if those themselves are experiencing any workplace abuses or exploitation, reach out to the community. So every Friday in TV Women's Center in Laban CBD, Migrante Laban hosts free consultation. So yeah, definitely reach out. We are also on Facebook and on Instagram, and you can share email around. So we, it's definitely very, very empowering to hear like workers speak out about their abuses. Even myself, I was very scared the first time that I was here, but with community and with this type of collective power, we can be able to demand even more support for us.
Yeah, definitely. And, you know, I think that's what these employees and the governments thrive on is, you know, people's fear and their silence as well, because a lot of people think that they're alone, or like you said, they're too scared to speak up because of their lack of protections, visa insecurity, things like that. So thank you so much, Jed, for joining us on the show this morning to speak to us about Migrante Australia, but also Laban Migrante. I'm sure that we'll have further updates as you continue to roll out more from the campaign and speak to more workers. But for now, we really appreciate your time on the show.
Yeah, no worries. I also wanted to there's a fundraiser event happening this Friday. It was organized by Concerned Artists of the Philippines. It's called Barangay Block Party. It's going to happen in Misfits Bar in Putre, 6 p.m. So it would feature a lot of Filipino culture and communities. There would be performances from artists, film showing stalls, and all the funds raised will be directed towards on-the-ground efforts to assist us with our Laban Migrante campaign.
Amazing, Jed. Well, thank you so much for that. We'll pop the information about that fundraising event in our show notes when we upload our podcast. And yeah, that's something that our listeners can do to support. So thank you so much, Jed.
No worries. Thank you so much for having me.
We've been speaking to Jed Pika about the systemic exploitation of Filipino and other migrant workers in so-called Australia, as well as the forced migration that is driving many people to seek work here. To learn more about the organisation and their campaign, you can follow Migrante Australia, that's MIGRANTE Australia, on Instagram. And remember, we'll pop the details of that fundraising event in our show notes later today.
Nemesis is a Palestinian-Canadian singer-songwriter from Milton, Ontario. This is her 2022 single, Immigrant's Tale.
This is a story of a girl, one who never saw the world beyond the walls of Jericho, a fairy tale yet to be told. Planned to be the first to leave before her innocence is sold. Now those days are out of reach. Her hands were forced to let them go. There she goes again, craving the attention of a stranger. See the child within, living out a fantasy that she once had. She whisper words till her return, and though her smile could bring her fame, they say the beauty was her curse. There she goes again, craving the attention of a stranger. See the
stories straight from community, culture, language, music, and more, all in one place.
Meet ICTV Play, the free on-demand streaming service from Indigenous Community Television.
Watch news, cooking, music, language programs, cultural shows, and heaps more videos made by Mob for Mob, anytime, anywhere.
On your phone, your tablet, or your computer, ICTV Play brings our stories to life and keeps us connected, no matter where we are.
Download the app today from your favourite app store or jump online at ictv.com.au/app.
Showing our way.
A 3CR supporter.
Do you have a few children's picture books or footy boots that your kids have outgrown but want to find them a loving home? Well, drop them in at 3CR and put them in the books and boots bin. Books and Boots regularly sends pre-loved children's picture books and sports footwear to remote and regional First Nations communities and children across the country. Contact us at Books and Boots or go to the website www.booksandboots.org.au. We love a good book.
You're listening to 3CR Tuesday Breakfast. This is Fiza and Julia's in the studio with us now. So up next, we'll be speaking to Sophie because the NTEU Unimelt staff members are striking this Thursday as part of the enterprise bargaining that first commenced last November. There will be a rally at 12 p.m. at the John Medley Building, as well as barbecue and live music at South Lawn. Speaking to us about this strike is Dr. Sophie Rudolph, who is a senior research fellow in the Faculty of Education at the University of Melbourne. She has been on the branch committee at UniMelt for about 8 years now and has been actively involved in two rounds of enterprise bargaining negotiations. This has also included organizing for industrial action, sitting at the union bargaining team, and organizing rallies and direct action. Good morning, Sophie. Welcome to 3CR.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
No, it's great to have you. Let's dive straight in. A strike has been called. Why has it been called? What are the demands of this stop work action?
Yeah, so we had a meeting of about, I think, just over 400 members a couple of weeks ago.
Yeah.
And we voted to strike this week, a half-day strike, because management continues to reject our claim for casual sick pay,
yeah,
and also is refusing to make real changes to workloads, which many of our staff have been suffering under for quite a long time. So we decided collectively as members that this wasn't good enough and that we needed to put some pressure on negotiations at the table, and we do that through taking industrial action. And so we're going to rally under the John Medley Building,
yeah,
which is also quite significant because this is a building that houses many staff in offices and also has classrooms for teaching. And the university is planning to pull that building down and then rehouse people in open plan offices, and there isn't a really proper plan around how people will be able to do their work effectively in their new spaces. So this is also a really big issue for staff who are really, you know, concerned about what that means for their work, and
yeah,
and also the waste of pulling down a building that is perfectly good and
yeah,
that is significant to people. So
quite a bit going on there. Yeah, exactly. As expected, naturally, I guess. Obviously the paid sick leave for casuals, and I believe there's a call for 17% super as well, is that right?
Yes, that's right.
For casuals. Yep. Has there been precedent for this demand? Like, have other universities actually been able to meet these demands?
Yeah, there's actually precedent for all of the ones that we're striking over. So for academic workloads, there's a precedent at Federation Uni, which have, in the last round, they won academic workload committees, which is something that we're calling for. We're calling for slightly different things, but along those lines.
Yeah.
For casual sick pay, the University of Sydney won that in the last round for casuals, 5 days per year of personal leave,
okay,
sick pay, and then 17% super for casuals was also won just recently by the University of Newcastle,
okay,
and they're going to introduce that by the start of 2030.
Okay.
So, yeah, there's
so it's been done and it can be done. That's good,
yes,
to know. But also besides the demands for casual, obviously just general workload conditions obviously has become quite the tipping point. What are, I guess, the current workload conditions? Because I'm guessing a lot of people are not aware about the workload conditions and, of course, the impact that this has on teaching, on professional staff and students as well.
Yeah, so workloads have been increasing over the last couple of decades across the sector, and including in schools as well, so across education and probably in other sectors as well. And there's been some big surveys of academic and professional staff around these kinds of workload problems. And it's being felt in a range of ways. There's like an increased admin burden, the volume of work that people are required to do in the time is too much. There's fragmentation of work, so lots and lots of different tasks that make the workload stressful and difficult. Academics are often reporting over allocation of teaching, so that means that they're struggling to do the other aspects of their work, like research and service. And the other thing that's happened over the last few years, particularly at Melbourne Uni but other places as well, is we've had a number of staff, professional staff restructures. And then a failure to fill vacancies from professional staff positions. So professional staff are also under immense pressure with workloads that are unmanageable. And I think this is a broader kind of issue related to the corporatisation of education. Where it values cost-cutting and profit-making and efficiencies rather than the relationships and the kind of human time that it takes for real learning and research and knowledge exchange to take place. So this is why this is such a big issue to us. And, you know, it has really felt consequences. And as we know, staff working conditions are student learning conditions. And so there's an issue in terms of being able to provide the kind of education that we know that our students deserve. And so that's why it's really important that we all work together at these times to fight for better conditions. And so, you know, I really encourage students as well at Melbourne Uni to ask their tutors and lecturers if they're going out on strike and how they can support them in that. They're welcome to come to the rally. You know, this is a really important time for us to come together. All of us, academic, professional and students, to really fight for better conditions all round.
And also this is a shout out to anyone who has not yet joined the union. There's still time to join the union before the rally on Thursday. So
that's right.
Just thought I'll slip that.
As soon as you join, you're protected
exactly.
to take industrial action.
But yeah, there's also an interesting demand in there for better provisions that protect staff against adverse effects of AI systems, which I thought was quite interesting. Could you expand on what those effects are, like just real briefly, and like what are safeguards, what kind of safeguards could we expect to mitigate that?
Yeah, so this is obviously, you know, a big issue at the moment, and there's been lots of discussion and debate about how do we protect against adverse effects of AI. And I think, you know, these are still these ongoing conversations as we try and work out how best to do this. But some of the things that we're calling for are that the uni won't use AI to the detriment of fair, meaningful and secure employment or to replace work. So really thinking about what, how can we ensure that people have their jobs and, and they're not taken away by AI systems. We're asking for transparent information about AI system use from the university so that people are aware of how the AI systems are being used. That all decisions that impact employees and their working conditions are made by humans. So we want to see that key decisions are not given over to AI systems. That there's human oversight over any work that AI is going to do. That there's no work to be used without attribution and consent, so really like looking after intellectual property, protection of student and staff data, and really importantly as well, protection of cultural heritage, language and self-determination of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander employees.
Yeah. That sounds incredibly important. So, yeah, that's good to know. I guess just to zoom out a little bit, we've obviously witnessed the relative success of the teachers' strike led by rank and file members of the AU. And earlier this month as well, there was an allied health worker. They had their second statewide strike as part of their current enterprise bargaining. As someone who's been a union member for quite some time, do you think this is a growing movement towards unionizing and organizing more broadly, or just an anomalous uptick? It's just election year. What do you think?
It's hard to know, I would say. and probably, like, we need longer to look back and sort of understand that. But I guess what I think it points towards is that the corporatisation of public institutions is increasingly demonstrating that this creates adverse effects, that people are suffering in these institutions under this corporatisation because it doesn't care about people and workers and relationships and the things that are important to make these things function. And it's taking away public assets. It's privatising or corporatising public institutions and assets. And I think, you know, and those things are like overwork and burnout and disconnection occur through that. And so I think people are feeling that in such an intense way at the moment, and what they're doing is coming together as workers and saying this is enough, and we're not prepared to endure this anymore, and we want to take back these public institutions, which are for human good. You know, their education, their health, they're things that we need, and they should be focused on humans and not on profit and, you know, money in the way that they have been being, you know, headed towards for such a long time. So, yeah, I mean, the capitalist state has really undermined worker capacity over the last, you know, many decades, probably, you know, 5 or so decades. And so that's, you know, that has made it really difficult for workers. But I think this is a really, you know, important time when people are saying, no, we're going to use what we have and we're going to stand up and make our demands known, and we're going to fight for them. And I think this is really important.
That's fantastic. So that's such a positive note to end on. So just very quickly, do you have any message to the general public at all who might not be part of their unions or the higher education space in general? Any last words for the public before we let you go?
I think just, you know, join your union and support unionists because this is how we put the power back into the hands of the people. And this is really important for our democracy and for our work and for building a better world.
Absolutely. Thank you, Sophie. That's, as always, it's such a joy to have you on the show, and look forward to chatting with you again soon. Thank you so much, Sophie.
Thanks for having me. See you.
See ya, bye. We've been speaking to Dr. Sophie Rudolph, Senior Research Fellow at the Faculty of Education at University of Melbourne, discussing about the upcoming strike by the NTEU Unimelt staff members as part of your enterprise bargaining. There will be a rally at 12 p.m. at the John Medley Building, which is also at risk, as well as a barbecue and live music at South Lawn. This is open to public, so we do encourage public to join us if you're free on Thursday for this strike. We are always better together. We'll be right back after these messages.
Women on the Line, a radical intersectional current affairs program.
Making space for the voices of women and gender diverse people.
Featuring in-depth conversations with guests from so-called Australia and beyond.
Ultimately, we're looking to care for country, to continue our culture, to continue our ceremonies, so that our children have a strong sense of self and belonging.
Just because our marginalisation intersects where we're both disabled. It doesn't change your white privilege. It doesn't change your straight privilege. It doesn't change your able-bodied privilege.
Sex work, the word itself, has been such a word with a lot of stigma. However, we cannot ignore that there are women out there who are making their livelihood out of this job.
Listen every Monday morning at 8:30 on 3CR Community Radio, 855 AM, or stream live on 3cr.org.au.
Love podcasts? We've got you. Find Women on the Line via the Community Radio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Women on the Line, we're about
feminisms in their multitudes,
First Nations sovereignty,
land back,
trans liberation, poo-poo on the turfs,
abolition,
anti-racism,
sex worker rights,
South liberation,
disability justice,
anti-imperialism,
decolonisation,
an end to borders,
workers' justice,
and so much more.
Women on the Line, broadcasting on the 3CR airwaves since 1986.
Woo!
Mel Fisher is a network spokesperson from the Anti-Poverty Centre. A report from the CSIRO has revealed that Australian homes are some of the most expensive to heat or cool, and households who live in 1.7-star homes pay more than six times in energy bills than those in living in energy-efficient homes. The report has found this affects those with lower incomes and renters higher. There has been a call to ensure that minimum standards of living must include higher levels of energy efficiency, particularly after comments from Senator Andrew Bragg and Tim Wilson from the Federal Liberal Party of South Australia that have revealed that they are seeking to weaken energy efficiency standards, claiming that those with lower incomes should just accept this standard of living. Thanks for coming on the show today, Mel, to speak to us about this.
Yeah, no problem at all.
So, can you tell me more about the energy efficiency standard and how it affects these, and why it affects renters more than homeowners?
Basically, so I lived in, before this house that I'm in now, I've never had energy efficiency at all. I've lived in, every place I've lived in has had no insulation, no heating or cooling, expensive water heaters, things like that. And, yeah, I've racked up bills that are like $6,000. Because I can't afford, like, during summer, I have a skin condition which I have to have cooling for, which for me in my old house was a box air conditioner I got for $30, which was not energy efficient at all. So, you know, we're already basically getting priced out of rentals. And if you're lucky enough to have a rental, the amount of rent that you're paying, you can't afford the extra cost of electricity either.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. So it sounds like, a lot of these politicians who are trying to lower these standards don't really hear these stories. Do you know why is this affecting renters more than homeowners?
Well, renters don't have the choice, the energy efficiency at all. Like, you know, they can't call up and organise insulation or, you know, decent water systems. So, they have no choice, you know. You can't make changes to a property, so half the time you don't get heating or cooling. This is up to landlords, also, you know, public housing to make sure their homes are energy efficient.
Yeah, exactly. And what are the other, like, health threats of living in a low energy efficient home?
So I basically, in summer here, it got to be 36 degrees overnight.
Wow.
And it did not cool down. And I literally thought I was going to die.
Yeah.
I felt sick. I felt like I was going to pass out. You know, and it does add, with climate change, it adds that extra element of danger because our homes get so hot.
Yeah.
They get so cold. I actually know someone that, you know, when he goes to sleep in winter, he wakes up and his eyelashes are frozen together.
Yeah.
Because he lives in a country area that temperatures are very low. You know, it's 2026. Mm-hmm. It's not like we can't make all homes energy efficient.
Yeah, exactly. It's so sad to hear, and also knowing that, yeah, it does mainly affect people with lower incomes. It's just, yeah, it feels very unfair. So how can homes become more energy efficient?
Keeping standards and making standards for energy efficient.
Yes.
So I'm very, very, very fortunate. I live in public housing.
Mm-hmm.
In that public housing, as I've stated, I've never had an energy-efficient home. I moved 3 weeks ago, and my new home is energy-efficient.
Yeah.
And the changes and the difference is absolutely amazing. I'm not too cold to actually do things. So in my old house in winter, most of the time I would literally have to stay in bed because I was too cold to actually do anything. My hands were frozen. You know, now I'm getting up and able to do things. My home stays warm. Mm-hmm. The difference is absolutely incredible.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. I think it's something you don't think about unless you face it, the fact that, yeah, your living conditions include your the temperature of your home, and that can like motivate you or change the way you behave in either a positive or negative way. And yeah, in this instance, yeah, it's a lot harder to kind of fulfill what you have to do in your day when your home is freezing and you don't feel like going out.
Exactly. It really does make it a lot harder. And, you know, in summer, with my ski condition,
mm-hmm.
I know that I have cooling and insulation here. So, you know, I know that I'm going to be okay. And that has taken so much stress off of me.
Yeah.
As I said, I ended up racking up a $6,000 electricity debt.
Yeah.
And that was just running my air conditioner in summer.
Yeah.
In winter, I wouldn't have a heater because I was too scared of the cost.
Yeah.
So, you know, it makes a huge difference to people.
Yes.
And with climate change,
yeah,
you know, it's a safety thing.
Yeah, it's only going to get, I guess, more extreme and harder to manage. Which is why it's so shocking that these Liberal politicians like Andrew Bragg and Tim Wilson are suggesting that these standards should be weakened. Yeah, what's your like thoughts on that?
I find it absolutely hilarious that they're saying this when I can guarantee that both their homes are energy efficient.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, yeah, I'm just like, why are we saying that those on lower incomes don't deserve energy efficiency?
Mm-hmm.
You know, when most people now are, it's been proven by everybody's home, that most people now who are earning under $130,000 a year are in rental stress.
Mm. Yeah.
You know, this is affecting more and more people. So, of course, we need energy-efficient homes.
Mm-hmm.
And, yeah, it's very, very easy for politicians to make these statements
mm-hmm.
when they haven't experienced what living in, you know, homes with no insulation is like.
Yes, exactly. It's always easier to like threaten something that's sort of a standard for you, but doesn't affect you, it's a lot easier to take that away. Yes. So what would you suggest is a way that we can tackle this issue and raise awareness of it and help people who are being affected by these energy efficient standards that could be potentially lowered or are already deficient?
Yeah, I believe that every home should be energy efficient. You know, I really don't care if we offer subsidies to landlords to make their homes energy efficient. It would not be my favourite policy, but at the same time, if it means someone on a lower income gets that energy efficiency, which will bring their power bills down, then I'm all for whatever works. Public housing, social housing, they should all be energy efficient. And I believe, like, Housing Trust in South Australia, as I said, I'm in housing. I've just moved into a home that is energy efficient, mm-hmm. That they've built, and it's a perfect home.
Yeah.
So it can be done. We just have to make policy and drag the government kicking and screaming to agree.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, I definitely agree. And, it should just be just a basic human right to have this energy efficiency standard. It's just unfair that some don't get that. I suppose for just my last question, is there anything else you'd like to say on the show in regards to this issue?
Yeah, I believe, honestly, that what you said is this is a human right, especially when we live in Australia, which we know the summers here get extremely hot.
Yeah.
Winters can get extremely cold. It's common sense that everybody should have energy efficiency. All those on low incomes are under rental stress.
Mm-hmm.
So to bring their power bills down at least would help.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, we shouldn't be adding to this stress and adding to, this experience of, living with a lower income and, like, making that condition worse for people. Yeah, I agree. Yeah, well, thanks for speaking with us today, Mel. We'll link any further information from the Anti-Poverty Centre on how people can find out, more about this in our podcast notes.
Sounds great.
Cool, thanks. You're listening to 3CR Tuesday Breakfast.
Hi, my name is Miss Kanina. I'm a proud Yoda, Jaja Rong, Kalkadun, and Yirrindali Aboriginal Sovereign Woman. And you're listening to 3CR, guys. Check in with your friends. Make sure you guys are going good. And also stick up for what's right, yeah? Free Palestine.
DigiTube, people, place, language. Connecting stories, culture, and language across Australia. Contribute your content in digitube.com.au. Sign up for a free account and select your options for streaming, download and broadcast promotion.
A 3CR supporter.
Bullying can be harder to spot these days.
Especially when it happens online.
Or when our kids keep it to themselves.
And even when we do spot it, knowing what to do next can be hard.
But we don't have to figure it out on our own.
There's support out there for Mob to help us recognise the signs and start the conversation.
Learn how to spot it and help stop it.
Visit letsstopbullying.gov.au.
Authorised by the Australian Government, Canberra.
A 3CR supporter.
You're listening to 3CR Tuesday Breakfast. Just before this messages, we were speaking to Mel Fisher, a network spokesperson from the Anti-Poverty Centre, about the threat of the standards of energy efficient levels in homes being reduced for those in lower incomes, which raises the cost of living, particularly within this changing climate and higher living expenses that everybody is facing. So, yeah, thank you, Mel, for that very important interview. Up next, we are going to share a speech from the rally opposing the No Air in Prison Bill that was held on the steps of Vic Parliament on Wednesday, 12th of August. Karen Fletcher, executive officer of Flat Out Inc., spoke out against the mass incarceration of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islanders, as well as the mistreatment of people with disabilities and are victim survivors of domestic violence in prison. She emphasizes the importance of understanding the root causes of issues impacting communities and fighting against this and other harmful bills. A bit of content warning, please note that in the following excerpt, Karen names several First Nations women who have died in custody. First Nations listeners can contact 13YARN, that's 139276, Yarning Safe and Strong, 1-800-959-563. Please take care when listening. Here is Rally MC Maggie Munn, First Nations Justice Director at the Human Rights Law Centre, introducing Karen.
I lied, actually. We have one more speaker. Karen, can you come down, please? In what may be her last rally as Flat Out's Executive Officer, Karen Fletcher.
But definitely not my last rally, you can get rest assured, maybe as Flat Out's exec officer. I just wanted to say it's been incredible to see the support for this build over the last couple of weeks, and just congratulate the Federation of Community Legal Centres, Human Rights Law Centre, Flat Out, Victorian Aboriginal Legal Service, and all the organisations that have come behind this, and in particular, the Council of First Peoples and the action that's being taken around treaty. This is a historic thing that is happening, the first test of treaty. Is this government actually committed to treaty or not? The issue of the rights of people in prison is a fundamental issue of colonisation in this country, and it is the mechanism by which colonisation is keeping a grip on Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander communities. It started with incarceration to get people off the land, and it continues with incarceration to keep people out of community and to destroy families and communities that are actually the only hope we have of peace and safety for people, not prisons. We want peace and safety. We need to build something else that's not about punishment, that's not about the abolition of human rights, that's about valuing people, helping people. Understanding the roots of of what's happened to people and has brought people into this situation where there is mass incarceration of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people, people with brain injuries. The group that spoke about the number of people in prison with brain injuries. This is an absolute shame on our system that people with brain injuries and disabilities, people who had horrific histories of family violence and violence as children, who've been disinherited from their land, from their families, who are living in overcrowded housing, who are homeless. The rates of homelessness amongst Aboriginal people is disgusting and is directly leading to their imprisonment. And then when they're released, there is also no housing. How is this contributing to family safety, to community safety? It is absolutely ripping apart the fabric of the communities that are the most important in our society. And I just want to say, look, this bill, we're going to fight this bill. We're going to fight to have this bill withdrawn. But if we don't get it withdrawn because we've got bipartisan support for it, that doesn't stop here, right? I've seen you all at rallies. This rally, the Bail Saves Lives rallies, the rallies that marked the death of Auntie Veronica Nelson, Heather Cal-Garrett, Tanya Day. We say their names. They are the people who are killed by this kind of legislation. And most recently, Tasha Golightly at the DPFC. These are the people that are harmed by this. And they're going to tell us that it's all about ultra-violent violent men.
But the people who are really in the prisons are people who are cycling in and out on remand, short terms. Half the time they're not even convicted. They've got alcohol and other drug issues. They've got disabilities. They've got family issues. These are the thousands of people cycling in and out of our prisons, being deprived of fresh air, being deprived of visits with their families, being deprived of phone calls, medical treatment programs, employment opportunities. These are the people that are really being impacted, and that's lies that this is about dealing with violent men. The violent men that have committed offences have been ones that have not been adequately supervised and surveilled. They're the ones where there's been police failures, where there's been a lack of care. And yet they throw them back in our faces and say, this is the reason why we have to implement these changes that are going to affect people who are already suffering. This is lies. Let's talk about who's really impacted. And the best thing about this rally today is we heard from the people who were impacted. And this is a new thing, right? This, the folks with brain injuries, the Fig Jam Collective, these people who have had this experience and can talk about it and are organising about it, this is something that is going to have an impact. And it might not be with this bill. I know everyone's feeling a little bit down. Are we going to be able to stop this bill? Even if we don't, we are building strength here. I can see this rally is three times as big as the last one we had, and the next one's going to be 10 times as big. Bipartisan agreement by these politicians is not the issue. The issue is the public, the community, us. That's where we need to build this support. That's where we need to be to win this. And I just want to congratulate everybody for being here. Urge you to the buckets are still around for the Fig Jam Collective. Urge you to build the organisation of people who've experienced prison and who are fighting against, you know, prison as the answer to every social problem that the politicians want to, you know, stand up and talk about, because it's election time. We don't deal on election timetables. We deal on human rights as an issue in itself that we have to stand on. It's not about short-term political gain. It's not about performance. It's about just fighting, starting small, getting a bit bigger, and fighting until we have homes, not prisons, education, not prisons, health, not prisons, and stop colonisation.
Thank you so much, Karen. When Karen and I caught up just before this started, we had been volunteered to tag team MC this rally, as we've done at a couple of rallies before, and we decided that I would do the MCing and then Karen would come through and light a fire under all of us as we leave. As Karen said, the fight doesn't stop here. We know that this bill will likely pass tomorrow, but that doesn't mean that we walk away not continuing the fight. We owe it not just to the powerful and brave folks who shared their experiences today, but we also owe it to those who didn't make it out, who couldn't share their experiences, and who are still inside, caged, not cared for. That concludes our rally today. We want to just grab...
That was Karen Fletcher, Executive Officer of Flat Out Inc., speaking at the rally to oppose the new air in prison bill on 12 August 2026. You can support Flat Out's work by heading to www.flatout.org.au. Up next, we will be listening to a song. Emily Wuramara is a singer-songwriter from Groot Island, an island off the coast of Australia's Northern Territory. She shares stories of country, family and culture sung in English and her traditional language, Anindilyakwa. This is Lullaby. Is it on? No. Is it on? Okay, at the end?
To the sky, Be kind, my darling, it'll only be a while. The sky gets dark, but the moon, she's my friend. And the stars that fill the sky tell stories of past and present. The trees whistle tunes, only they would know. Whispering to the wind as she flies through the air. Lullaby, where were you when I was down? Beckoning, beckoning me now. Lullaby, where were you when I was hurt like before? And now I hide. Hello, my friend, it's nice to see you again. Oh, we've had lots of fun, but now our time is up. Oh, and the bird said to the beast, life me endlessly. Memories won't escape, but what is memories when people change? And the heart whispered to the ears, listen closely. You'll never know what you hear. And the ear said to the mouth, say it slowly.
That was Emily Wuramara, singer-songwriter from Groot Aylin, singing Lullaby. So just before we wrap up today's show, a quick shout out that there is a gathering for UCO tomorrow at 8:45 a.m. in front of the Supreme Court of Victoria. We encourage the public to join Rising Red Lantern as they gather in solidarity and remember UCO, beloved Asian migrant sex worker who was killed in November 2024. So that's all we have on the show. This morning we started off at 7:15 with a repeat from Out of the Blue. Presenter Sabrina spoke to Dr. Kim Reed about El Nino, which is a climate pattern that's happening right now. And Dr. Reed explained what El Nino means and how it affects weather patterns over the globe, not just in Australia. At 7:30, we were joined by Jet from Laban Migrante, speaking about this new alliance of grassroots migrants organizations of Filipinos and their families in so-called Australia, fighting against the exploitation of migrant workers and advocating for their rights and welfare. And then at 7:45, we were joined by Dr. Sophie Rudolph, branch committee member at UNIMELP NTEU, talking more about the strike that's happening this Thursday. There will be a rally at 12 p.m. at the John Medley Building, as well as a barbecue and live music at South Lawn that the public are encouraged to join.
At 8 a.m., we spoke with Mel Fisher, who is a network spokesperson from the Anti-Poverty Centre, about those living in energy efficient homes and the standards that are being lowered as threatened by Liberal MPs. And lastly, at 8:15, we listened to a interview with Karen Fletcher, that was a speech opposing the No Air in Prison bill that was held on the steps of Vic Parliament on Wednesday, the 12th of August, which spoke out against mass incarceration of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islanders, as well as people with disabilities, and threats and facing domestic violence in prison.
And that's all we have for you this morning on the show. This is 3CR Tuesday Breakfast. Stay tuned for Accent of Women.
3CR would like to thank our sponsors, Earth Greetings, cards that connect, care, and celebrate. Support wildlife and habitat with every purchase.
3CR Breakfast would like to thank the New International Bookshop, Melbourne's radical bookstore and venue, for their financial support of this program. You can find Nibs opposite reception in the Lygon Street wing of Trades Hall Carlton. You can buy books online and keep up to date with upcoming events at nibs.org.au.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.